on 2 meters on 144.390, I think it is. It'll be reporting its position while it's over the United States. They expect it to go to 40,000 feet. It will then slip over and start transmitting over the Atlantic at 10 megacycles. And then when it gets over to Europe, it has the right kind of circuitry on board by way of global positioning satellite. It knows what frequency, what position it's on, and therefore it's going to flip back to a 2 meter frequency for automatic positioning. So for those who are interested in satellite type balloon-borne ham radio, you might want to go to that website, utarc.org. And that was just brought to my attention an hour ago by K2 Charlie X-Ray, Steve, who brought that to my attention. He keeps track of these things. Steve also has an interest in 160 kilohertz type transmissions, you know, these super low frequency things that take place by way of a Anderson alternator, I think it's called, Alexander Anderson alternator from Scandinavia. He also keeps track of those transmissions. Wonder if you heard about that one, Mel. I'm hearing about it for the first time tonight. K2KEY in the group. K2RW in the deck man.
W2EWK.
Okay, hold on. Yeah, I have not heard of this, but it sounds like, you know, a very interesting experiment. Did you say it was going to be on, they were going to transmit on 10 megahertz? Is that the transmission, the HF transmission will take place on the 30 meter band, Dick, over?
That's correct. They will be transmitting on the 30 meter band, 10 and a fraction megacycles, I think it's 10.15 megacycles, when it's over the Atlantic. When it's over the United States, it will be transmitting on the 2 meter band for the frequencies that are ordinarily used by ham radio APRS, which I think is 144.390. Eugene, you had a question or a comment? Go ahead, Eugene.
Yes, at what time? On 144.390.
Good question. When you go to that website, they will give you this announcement, and they say it's going to be launched this week. They didn't say exactly when it's going to be launched. I am guessing it's weather-dependent. In other words, if I was the University of Tennessee Amateur Radio Club, I've got this pretty expensive piece of equipment with a great big balloon that's going to take it to 40,000 feet. I'd want to be making sure I'm making measurements of the weather report. I'd want to know what the winds are doing at 40,000 feet. I'd like to know that the winds are blowing from the west towards the east that particular day, so it takes my balloon in the right direction. Their intention is to launch it over the United States and Tennessee, have it drift over the Atlantic, and go to Europe. That's their intention. So the exact hour and day of launch has not yet been determined, and I think when you go to that website, you'll get some more information on that. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Okay,
Zach,
W2WK. Give me the website. Go back to slow.
Okay. The website is like every other website that begins with www.utarc.org. So utarc.org, which stands for University of Tennessee Amateur Radio Club .org. That's what it stands for. QSL, Eugene?
Okay, QSL 100%. Thank you very much, Dick. Dick, let me make a comment what he said about the tree. Okay? About the tree. What couldn't he use PVC pipe with a angle to it? You know, you put the angle and put that PVC pipe into that and tighten it down and using that for the angle. QSL from W2WK.
Yeah, I'm sure he could have used PVC pipe, but it would have been a little bit more obvious. It's a little bit brighter, that white pipe high in the tree, as opposed to his nice three-quarter inch diameter EMT tubing. So I'm guessing the tubing is a little bit less visible. And it's the material he had available. I'm putting words in Mel's mouth here. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, let me tell you about that. This is K2KEY. All right, first of all, comments on this. You this, the launch most likely will be mentioned on Newsline, that the ARRL has what they call Newsline that I copy. And either you get the Newsline, you can get it either on voice or CW. And so if it's going to be a launch, when Newsline will cover it. They always do cover any of these specialized activities dealing with amateur radio satellites. They have their also their satellite news every time as part of their Newsline broadcast. So if you listen to Newsline, ARL's Newsline, you'll most likely will get the exact day and hour of the launch when it's decided. Why didn't I use PVC? Okay, now, at the top of the PVC, you can use one of these right angle, you know, 90-degree type connectors that you glue on to it, you know. If you pull down on that, if you stick an arm out, like maybe about what I have, maybe about 2 feet out, and then you have to, you put a pulley on that, the fulcrum pull of that with the weight, just the weight, pulling up that dipole, you know, it's amazing when you pull up a piece of wire that looks like it weighs nothing, when you pull up the end of it with a piece of coax, RG8U coax on it, you will break it. I tried that once and someplace else, and boy, I broke it right at that joint, Dick, over.
Okay, Mel, do you know what time the launch is going to be? It's going to be on Saturday?
Don't know. I don't know, Eugene. You have to listen to Newsline. They will announce it, I'm sure. They always announce any special projects and all that, different clubs or whatever, especially a thing of this magnitude. I guarantee it will be on Newsline, Eric. Eugene, excuse me. Go ahead.
Okay, very good, very good. I'll get back to Dick for a second. Dick, I got a question for you. But Mars, QSL?
Fire away with Mars. We've got our space expert, Paul, on frequency. So give us your Mars question, Eugene.
Okay. If there's water up in Mars, okay, if we took a rocket ship and went there, right, what will be, how soon can we get there and how soon can we come back? That's number one. QSL?
Oh, that's a big question. Yeah, the amount of water on Mars is believed to be quite small. They see evidence of it at the North Pole. They think there's water there in the frozen form along with the frozen carbon dioxide at the North Pole. But for the most part, Mars is a very dry planet. It's kind of a cold desert with very little air pressure. So it's not a great place to take a vacation. To my knowledge, the best way to get there would be the way we sent some of our space probes. It's about a one-year trip from Earth to Mars. After you land on Mars, you would stay there for roughly 1 year so that Mars or Earth are back in the right position to come back home. And then another trip from Mars back to the Earth, about a year. So it's close to a three-year mission to send a man to Mars. I don't think anyone has come up with any technique that would be significantly faster than that. That's one piece of news. The other piece of news is the size of a spaceship that would be able to contain, let's say, three astronauts with all of their consumables, which means a continuous flow of water, oxygen, and food, and take care of all the waste products. To my knowledge, that problem has not been worked out. The total amount of consumables required for a three-year mission is, by my standards, very significant. As it is right now, the International Space Station, with two astronauts or three astronauts on board, has a Progress ship come up from the Soviet Union with supplies something like once every month or two. I'm going to check with Paul on that one. Roughly how often, Paul, do the Progress ships that bring supplies, the consumable supplies, to the International Space Station? Is there about one of those every month or two, WS2N? K2LIW.
Dick, I have another question too.
Hey, yeah, you got about every 6 weeks, Dick, I would say progress is scheduled. If not, a space shuttle will be going up. If not, a Soyuz craft. So, you know, if a Soyuz craft is going up, then, you know, you'll have a, let's say 2 months, you'll have 4 months spread, you know, something like that. We're a long way off, Eugene, from doing that. But we do have a lander going there right now. It's on its way, called the Phoenix, and it's going to be landing in the northern hemisphere, near the poles, in that direction. And it's going to have a big scoop on there. It's going to dig down into the surface, and we're going to find out what's underneath that surface. So, I don't think you're going to be swimming anytime soon, Dick.
I'll call. I know there's another person with a question. First, I'll call. Phoenix is due to land roughly when, if you happen to know?
Let's see. It's been going a couple of months. Usually, what, 9 months or 10 months? So it's probably this summer, I guess, this summer in that area. I'll have to check the internet, but I don't know, May, June, July, something like that.
Okay, there's something to look forward to this summer, as well as the GLAST being launched this coming summer. Eugene, you had another question?
Yes, in my church today, the funny thing was mentioned, you know, in Sunday school, okay? In Sunday school, they said that the moon, you know, is drifting, you know, a certain distance, then the moon will come back to Earth very, very close to Earth. Then the moon would ricochet like a boomerang and go back into orbit. Is this true?
I think no. The moon is very slowly moving outward. I think the answer is approximately 1 inch per year. The moon's orbit is getting larger. A few million years ago, the moon was at one-third the distance it is right now. It is slowly moving outward. The interaction between the moon, the Earth, and our tides is slowly coupling some energy. The rotational energy from the Earth is slowly being coupled into the moon's orbit by way of the tidal action. So the day on Earth, a few million years ago, the day on Earth was shorter than 24 hours, and the moon was closer. The moon is slowly in the process of moving outward. I'm not sure of the exact number, but I think it's approximately 1 inch per year. So it's going to take a long time to get much further out. Will the moon come back and hit us again? I don't think so. Even if it's going to happen, it's going to take hundreds of millions of years. And, Eugene, you still have time to repent. Back to you, Eugene.
Y.O.
Okay, thank you, Dick. W2WK, go ahead.
Y.O., you got it. Give us your full call and name.
K2YO, my name is Bernie. Dick, isn't the moon in an elliptical orbit around the Earth? I missed the other gentleman's call, but what he heard was that the moon does move further and closer away from us. If it's an elliptical orbit, that's definitely true. I think this is a little bit rusty. Does anybody else know? But I believe that all of the planetary orbits are actually slightly elliptical.
Well, the word elliptical is relative. By that I mean every single orbit is elliptical. It's only the extremely exact, rare situation when you have a circular orbit. Most orbits, whether it be planets going around the sun or whether the moon is going around a planet, most of the time the orbit in time becomes slightly more circular. Very few orbits become more elliptical. Most of them become more circular. There's a coupling mechanism called gravity hydrodynamics that sort of does that for you. There's a couple of exceptions to this, yes. If you're talking about Jupiter, which has got a zillion moons going around, and I think there's something like 30 moons going around Jupiter, and do those moons ever interact so that one of the moons gets a slightly more elliptical orbit? Yes, that can happen. But we've only got one moon. our moon is slowly moving outward, and if you wait in time, I'm relatively sure that our orbit is becoming slightly more circular, not more elliptical. Back to you, Bernie.
Didn't mean to imply that we're becoming more elliptical. I was just taking what he had heard, that the moon is approaching the Earth and then skips off. To a layman, that would be a partial explanation, or that could be a layman's explanation. Oops, sorry about that.
I hear you, Bernie, and I think it's very unlikely. Not impossible, but very unlikely. And when it comes to the dynamics of the Earth-Moon, by the way, there's something like 140 moons going around the what I think are 9 planets of this particular solar system, 140 known moons, and would you believe only one of them does not have a name? The Moon. Ours is the only one that doesn't have a name. There are 10 to the 22 observable stars in the universe, and most of the major stars all have a name, except for one, the Sun. So we're not so good at naming the stuff that's real important to us. But most orbits... Oh, what was that?
Don't they call it Sol?
Yeah, you could, but is that an official name? Some people think not. But most of these orbits become slightly more circular in time. The elliptical orbit is not as stable. Now, you've got exceptions to that. You put up a satellite in a Molinia orbit, a highly elliptical orbit around Earth, where the perigee starts touching the top of the atmosphere. Yeah, you can get some funny dynamics going on and shifting of orbital plane, right ascension of ascending node can shift, apogee, perigee, all of these things can all shift around in funny ways. But our moon is so far out, it does not touch our atmosphere, and so I don't think we have to worry about it doing anything we don't like for many hundreds of millions of years to come. To have the various planned missions to try to confirm whether or not in one of those very dark craters at the top of the moon, right where at its north pole, could there be water left on the lunar surface in frozen form. I'm very doubtful of this because the moon has no atmosphere. In other words, the whole lunar surface is bathed in about the hottest vacuum you can get. And as such, ice, in my opinion, evaporates a lot more slowly than liquid water, but it still evaporates. When you go directly from the solid state to the gaseous state, it's called sublimation, and ice will sublime. You leave your tray of ice cubes in your refrigerator for a long enough period of time, and as long as your defroster mechanism in your refrigerator is working properly, in about a year or so, you will have a dry ice cube tray. Maybe it takes a year and a half, but the ice slowly evaporates. And that's what it does on Earth under normal atmospheric pressure. You take the hard vacuum of the lunar surface, and I'm very skeptical there's any substantial amount of water in frozen form or in liquid form on the moon. Now, when it comes to the water we've got on Earth, the strongest belief right now is that water was brought here by the comets. Comets contain water, and when they crash into the Earth, they deposit their water on the Earth. And there was a lot of comet and asteroid crashes into the Earth in our early history. And so, are comets crashing into the moon and depositing their water? It's possible, but it's my belief that that water doesn't last very long. But that's a belief. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call at KQRIW, the TechNet.
WS Glenn.
Go ahead, Paul.
I've heard that 1 inch per year with the moon going further away from the Earth many, many times. I've read that quite a few places, Dick, so I think you're right on with that. And water, I don't know, I think you might still have something down in the craters there. It's not, you know, mixed in with the ice, you know, you might have ice and minerals and detected hydrogen coming from those areas, though. So, you know, from the spacecraft, from the Clementine spacecraft, from the Prospector spacecraft. And then they're going to have another one that's going to be going up moon reconnaissance mission. They're going to have a launch next year, and we're going to put a spacecraft in orbit around the moon. Again, look for the telltale signs of some kind of water in the craters. I'm hoping there is, because to bring water, to bring any 1 pound of water from the Earth to the moon requires that 150 pounds of things, you know, fuel or you know, some kind of weight. 150 pounds are wasted in trying to get 1 pound of anything to the moon.
Yeah, I think the 150 pounds is a low number, Paul. I've heard numbers like thousands of pounds of fuel are required to get 1 pound of material to the moon. I think the number used to be 500 pounds required to get 1 pound of material into orbit. And maybe I'm wrong on that one. And getting to the moon is a lot further away than just being into low Earth orbit. So, yeah, bringing water there is an expansive process, depending on how you rate the word expansive. And if they detect hydrogen on the moon, I'm a little worried about, is that hydrogen coming from water? Yes, if you deionize, if you disassociate water molecules, H2O, you get two H's and one oxygen out of each molecule of water that you break up, and I guess ultraviolet exposure could be doing that, and is that where the hydrogen is coming from? And if they detect the hydrogen, how come they haven't detected the oxygen? Is the hydrogen just an outgassing of the lunar surface from various meteorites and other things that have hit it? Is it really water breaking up? Lots of questions I've got there. Now, my little philosophy about water in frozen form subliming, in other words, jumping directly from solid state to the gaseous state in hard vacuum, my belief is that water in frozen form continuously evaporates. The one thing that's not so comfortable about that opinion is, if that's true, then how does the water get onto the comet? How does the comet get water? And how does it hold on to its water in order to crash into the Earth and deposit the water? Because the comet is also into a hard vacuum. So I've got a problem with my own opinion on this one, as you can tell, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW on the deck now.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Well, how did it get there? Maybe from a previous, we've been around, 5 billion years. We're a second or third generation of star systems. So in other words, before we even existed, there might have been other ones. In fact, they know there were other ones. And these things went from supernova, and all the elements were created. All this was going on before the solar system was even formed. So that's where you could have gotten it originally. But how is it staying on a comet? Out in deep space, minus 450 degrees. The moon is, I think, on the south shore, the south pole, they said minus 170 degrees on it. That's relatively warm compared to the cold comet. So that might be one explanation there.
Okay, I sort of like that. And space has a basic temperature of 3 degrees Kelvin. As long as that comet is far enough out for most of its life, I guess it's cold enough to hang on to its water. And when comets come in close to the Earth, they start boiling up their water, and that may be one of the explanations for where the comet's tail comes from when it gets close to the sun. So I guess a comet could suddenly be kicked into a highly elliptical orbit where it used to be out there in the Oort cloud or in the Kuiper belt, and it gets kicked into an orbit where it comes down and crashes into the Earth a billion years ago, and it deposits its water onto the Earth before it would have been evaporated by a near flyby of a near flyby of the sun, if that's what it was going to do. Okay, that's a possible explanation. And I guess the vapor pressure of subliming water from solid ice being kept at 3 degrees Kelvin, the black body background temperature of free space, 2.73 degrees Kelvin. Maybe that evaporation rate is so slow that water can stay on a comet for a long time, as long as the comet stays away from the sun. Maybe that's the explanation. Mars doesn't fall into that category. Mars and the moon are rather close to the sun compared to a good comet. And so for them to hold on to their water is a difficult thing. Mars is believed to have no atmosphere because the solar wind is a bunch of, a zillion pounds of material boiling off the sun continuously, and it flies at us at a million miles an hour. And it hits the Earth's magnetic field, gets deflected around the Earth. The little bit that penetrates, that hits the North Pole and the South Pole, we call it aurora borealis and aurora australis, the little bit of material from the solar wind that strikes our atmosphere. But for the most part, our magnetic field creates that deflection. It's a beautiful safety shield. However, Mars has essentially no magnetic field, therefore it does not have that safety shield. Therefore, that solar wind has continuously been peeling away Mars, the atmosphere on Mars, and that's one of the explanations for why Mars has 0.7% of the atmospheric pressure we have on Earth, essentially no atmosphere. So a tough place to go. I'm skeptical that you want to send an astronaut there just to say you've done it. I'd much rather see them send an unmanned space probe. You get a lot more for your money with a heck of a lot less risk. I don't know why you'd want to send a man to such a terrible place. But that's an opinion. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me a call at us right now. K2LAW in the TechNet.
WSON about the plastic bike.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, in the northeast, or anywhere in the north, to use PVC to actually hold anything, especially something that could be moving, like antennas up in the tree like that. PVC tends to crack when you get it below freezing. You hold PVC at 0 degrees, let's say, for any period of time. That stuff becomes very brittle. Unless you buy a type of PVC, they call it CPVC, chlorinated PVC. And then that has another form that tends to bend. You know, it's just not as rigid as regular PVC. So you have to go with metal or something angle iron or something with some strength.
I think the
2BXL.
Mr. BXL, go right ahead.
On the Mars exploration story, I don't think I heard anybody mention, unless I wasn't really paying full attention, which is possible, that Discovery Science, I think usually referred to as the Science Channel, which is channel 170 here in Brooklyn on Cablevision, has been running a six-part series called Mars Rising, which they're talking about all the challenges of a manned Mars mission. And I'm sure, well, I think they've already shown the first three or four new episodes. Anyone who watches them with any frequency at all knows they rerun everything again and again and again and again. Very interesting. Anyway, back to you, BB2BXO.
Yeah, I think part of the motivation for doing that, Frank, is the fact that every single high school student has two particular opinions in common. When I say everyone, 90-some-odd percent of the high school students are positive computers are going to be very important in their future, and they all want to be computer savvy. Item number one. Item number two. Every high school student feels that Mars is the next major challenge for NASA, particularly a manned mission to Mars. And NASA being smart in that they
they have to keep their public happy, would have to create educational material in that direction. However, I never hear anyone mention the consumable problem. Whenever they talk about Mars missions, they talk about the rocket power, they talk about the amount of space that people will have, what's it like to live for a year at a time with near zero gravity, can they recreate artificial gravity? They discuss everything except the consumables. And the Frank Grossman that I know, I believe he consumes an amount of air, oxygen, water, and food in 1 year that has the approximate volume of your house on Avenue M and the approximate mass of your house on Avenue M. That's what I believe you consume in 1 year, Frank. And if you're going on a 3-year mission, and I have to give you 3 houses worth of consumables, that's a serious engineering challenge. And of course, we're all going to sit here and say, okay, we're going to recycle. As you've probably heard me say before, can you imagine the degree of difficulty of recycling every single molecule of liquid, gas, and solid material that is emitted by a human being for 3 solid years? You must recycle every single molecule to really have enough consumables for that mission. That's a very complicated piece of machinery. And heaven help you if that machinery breaks down while you're 300 million miles away from Earth. That machinery breaks down, you no longer have the recycle capability, and I think it's game over. I think you see what I'm getting at here. It's a very difficult problem, and I never hear anyone discussing it. But maybe I'm just listening to the wrong program. WB2BXO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, obviously you've looked me up on QRZ.com. very good. yeah, now that I think about it, they talk a lot about the human factors issues, the astronaut selection issues, and that sort of thing, which does interest me because I work in a related field in terms of career counseling and assessments and the like. So those assessment and selection issues in themselves are very interesting to people like myself. Yeah, but I don't, you're right. I do not think I've heard them, those issues mentioned very much at all. And as you said, I think the reason is nobody quite knows how to solve them yet. Maybe you're going to shoot up a launch very quick rockets every couple of months. Maybe another way to do it, I read it some science fiction somewhere, launch ahead of time unmanned vehicles with consumables in the proper trajectory to intercept the outgoing spacecraft and returning spacecraft at the right point. Probably a very expensive solution, but that's one thing off the top of my head I think of that might conceivably be doable.
Yeah, but as you said, very expensive. I mean, right now, Paul has just told us that the Progress spaceships from the Soviet Union every 6 weeks bring up consumable materials for the 2 astronauts that are on the International Space Station. Thousands and thousands of pounds of stuff are brought up every 6 weeks to maintain those astronauts. And to have a whole string of supply ships along the whole path between Earth and Mars for the trip on the way out and on the trip on the way back. Wow. Difficult maneuver. A lot of hardware being put in space and a lot of simultaneous, a lot of sequential rendezvous required to meet up with all of those supply ships that were sent ahead of time. A lot of careful timing required. Difficult mission. And if you want to recycle everything, I mean, this Earth that you and I are on now, Frank, recycles every molecule that comes out of you and me. Every breath of air you take contains molecules that were once inside of every single lung of every single human being that has ever walked this planet. You and I are recycling all of those air molecules. When it comes to all of the solid, liquid, and gaseous waste that you and I generate, the Earth does recycle all of those. But I think you could say the Earth takes 100 years to do it. You ain't got that time on, and it's using a lot of resources, you know, a lot of rain and wind and weather and ultraviolet exposure and solar exposure and everything else is required, and a lot of microbes and bacteria are eating up your and my waste products, reconverting it into something else, and eventually it all comes back again reusable. But I think I could make a case that the Earth takes 100 years to do that. And now to try to make artificial machinery to recycle every single molecule. You can't spare a single one on that 3-year mission as I see it. You don't dump anything over the side. You reuse everything. And I can envision some rather unpleasant scenarios if that machinery breaks down. So there's a very serious problem of what's required to maintain a human being. We take that for granted. We get up in the morning and all night long we've been breathing the air that the atmosphere has been supplying for us. We walk into the bathroom, we open up the faucet and there's the water. We take a drink of water, we go to the refrigerator, we get the food. I mean, this Earth and this society is supplying all kinds of stuff that we sort of take for granted. And when you're out in space and you're in your own little capsule and the whole world is a couple of cubic feet around you in that space capsule, and that all has to be maintained, there's some serious engineering challenges there. I've expressed this opinion once before to the Astronomical Society of Long Island. I'm an ASLI member. And I got a lot of flack on that one. People were very unhappy with me. They thought I was being overly negative. I'm not trying to be overly negative. I'm in favor of space, and to a certain degree, I'm in favor of manned space missions. But I think we have to face certain realities in order to know what the problem is, in order to start applying a solution. You have to first admit you've got a problem before you can start thinking about a solution and engineering a solution. We have to first admit that this problem exists. And among the majority of people I talk to, they haven't yet come to the conclusion that this is a problem. And to me, that's a problem. K2KEY. Mel? We can go on to other subjects if you like, and I bet you've got a mailbag that's got a couple of good questions. K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech man.
Okay, K2KEY. You know, one question, is there anything in the future that possibly will make these trips faster or shorter? In other words, right now, all these devices have to ring around and go around a number of times to pick up the momentum because they don't have enough fuel to make a direct trip. Is there any possibility that there will be a development, maybe in a new propulsion system, Dick, so that these trips can be made more direct over?
Without a doubt, the answer is yes. What you're describing is called specific impulse. Are we engineering propulsive systems that have a higher specific impulse? In other words, for each pound of fuel, how many pounds of thrust for what length of time do you get? That's the so-called specific impulse. By way of an ionic engine, you can get, I'm going to pick a number, 5 times more efficiency than you can out of a chemical burning engine, a rocket engine. The good news with an ionic engine, you get a lot more efficiency. The bad news is you get a very small amount of thrust, but if you've got the time to apply it for a long period of time, you can build up some pretty nice velocities with an ionic engine. And those experiments are going on as we speak. In order to make the mission to Mars not a 3-year mission, but to make it a 3-month mission, I'm guessing you'd have to have a specific impulse improvement of something like 1,000 to 1. Will that happen? Probably. Will it happen in your and my lifetime? I'm skeptical. So, without a doubt, we're moving in that direction. And will we discover some brand new propulsion system, a hydrodynamic drive, a warp drive, to put it into to Star Trek vocabulary. Will we be able to go to warp 8? Will we ever exceed, even come close to the speed of light? Not in our lifetime, I don't think. Are we going to find some way of making an anti-gravity machine or some other kind of electrostatic, electromagnetic propulsion system? Yeah, it's all possible. Nuclear propulsion was proposed at one time. But lots of development's going to be required before that happens. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. But we got to keep trying. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Well, like I say, anything that man conceives eventually, you know, starts out as science fiction, but surely becomes science fact after a few points. And I mean, you know, if we just look at our bodies, conveniences such as cell phones and TV is what we're doing right this minute. And, you know, we go back not too long ago, we'd say impossible, not possible at all. You would have the best of the geniuses of science stand there and shake their head and say you're dreaming, you know, strictly Buck Rogers type of thinking about any of the things, like I say, that we take for granted for now. So, like you say, it may not happen in all our lifetime, but I'm sure someday there's going to be some major breakthroughs, just like everything else, you know. We're very, very skeptical about a number of things that became so common in a few years. So, you know, just like you say, I always keep an open, I never, anyone that says to me impossible, I shake my head. I said, maybe right now, but for the future, I've said, it'll be possible. I'm sure if we put enough effort into anything, you know, we'll solve it. If there is an answer somewhere, which I'm sure there is, we'll find it. All right. I think we sort of covered that quite a bit. Shall I open the mailbag?
Yes. One other thing, though, Mel. A lot of science fiction does become science fact. Not all of it. When it comes to the complicated procedure of getting a person from orbit around the planet down to the surface, a very complicated, costly procedure, and Star Trek got around that by having the beam me down, Scotty. I forget what it's called, the transporter. Transporter is a nice piece of science fiction. Today, I was at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, where, as you know, the code was broken by Crick and Watson, and I met Mr. Watson, by the way, today. Had a very brief conversation with him. And so when you look at what is involved in the complication of one strand of DNA in one cell of your body, and I'm not sure what the exact number is, but if I took the cells of my body and I took the DNA code and I stretched it all out, I think it would reach to the moon and back. So to say that a human being, the 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 11 cells, each one of them having this very complicated DNA code, to say that you, with your transporter, are going to break that all down, transmit it as some kind of an electronic signal, and properly reassemble it at the other end, to say you're going to do that, that we're going to have a transporter, that is science fiction cubed or quadrupled. Not in 10 lifetimes are we going to see that, in my opinion. Much too complicated. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. And this is KQKY, not in our lifetime. It was a very good science fiction book that was written, I'm just passing one more word and then we'll go on, that was written right after World War II, and by this, forget his name, he was a famous science fiction writer, and he just died, in fact, the last couple of years, he wrote quite a bit, and it was about a base, about a flying saucer, basically, that landed, and they took it apart, and they said that the controls, electronic controls were so small that they had to be looked at under a powerful microscope, that all the electronics were so miniaturized that they had to look at it under a microscope, and they said, you know, it was pure science fiction. Basically, he was describing integrated circuits, takeover.
Oh, yeah, and some of the integrated circuits and some of the memory techniques are definitely getting down to the molecular level. Only a small number of molecules are required for each individual gate. Moore's Law, which was invented somewhere around the late 60s, I think Mr. Moore said that we're going to double the number of junctions, double the number of transistors on a microprocessor every 12 months, and that our major devices are going to double the number of lines of code every 18 months. He said those two rules, he didn't expect them to become laws, in the late 60s, and various experts said, yeah, they do a very nice job of projecting what the next few years are going to be like. But if you're doubling every year, starting in 1968, and that was 39 years ago, almost 40 years ago, 2 to the 40 power is an extremely big number. And so that's how much more complicated our microprocessors are going to become. Various experts said we're going to run out of capability to keep that up in 10 or 20 years. Well, here we are 30-some-odd years later, 38, 39 years later, and we're still on track with that rule of his, and so it's amazing the hell out of everybody. Can we keep it up? Don, interesting question. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is Kate. What's your thing, Colin? Oh, my wife just said Asimov. He wrote this book, Asimov wrote this book years ago. You remember, he was a famous science fiction writer, and he, you know, at that time, before, I mean, the really transistor really wasn't even known, really, as it was, you know, I could say an experiment in a laboratory, and here he envisioned putting millions of them on a little chip-type device, and this is what they found on the so-called flying saucer that crashed, you know, fictionally crashed someplace, and when they tried to figure out, you know, the controls and everything in it, they saw that they were so small that they said that they had only been seen under a powerful microscope. And, of course, it was science fiction, but there was there was science fact hidden, you know, today. Let's face it, if you want to look at a little miracle device, not too few years ago, we would have said that the cell phone was not possible to put together in the size that we have of now, Dick. So, like I say, I always say never say, you know, it can't be done. It just may take time, but I have a feeling we could see into the far future. We see at the airport now leaving for so-and-so place on Mars, you know, Tranquility or Moon Tranquility, based on the moon at 3 o'clock, you know, regular flight from JFK or something. I can say I would not be surprised if we could see in the crystal ball something like that happening maybe many generations from now, but I'm sure it will. All these things will come to bear. All right, so we go on now with the mail. Over.
Absolutely. By the way, Asimov is the guy you're talking about, Isaac Asimov. And my wife and I have both met him at a science fiction conference. He is an extremely prolific science fiction and science fact writer. His expertise was in biology. He was a professor of biology. And when he was about to write his 100th book, he entitled it Opus 100. Well, he wrote in his lifetime more than 300 books, and the combination of writing and editing, he was involved in more than 500 books. That is a prolific writer. So, Isaac was quite a guy. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, Mona just said that she was someplace and he was signing books, so she had to buy this book with my daughter, and he signed it. He was at that time in the city. How long ago was that? Oh, 20 years ago. That's right. 20 years ago. All right, very good. So, let's say he was very futuristic in a lot of his writing. So, I'm looking up opening mail right now. Let me just say something about the mail, first of all. I did get some comments, and I better make this comment really quick, because it repeated itself last week. I have seen some of the comments. Dick and I do not get together during the week and discuss the mail, the emails. This is all spontaneous. I'm looking at most of this stuff for the first time, and we cannot. I know I skip over these ones that go for pages. We cannot discuss, you know, things that go for many pages that are got lots of complicated mathematics. I'm not going to bring that up on the TechNet because this is not for the average amateur radio. If you have things that are, that you'd like to, you know, get involved with, that is advanced, you know, in the field of engineering, I don't think that this is the forum for it. So I'm sorry, that's why I do skip over some of them. Dick, they are literally species of all kinds of things that very interesting. I mean, if you want to sit down and look it over, but I don't think it's within the realm of the TechNet over.
Yeah, I'm going to add a few words to that one. It is a very nice compliment that Mel and I get, and that some people will be doing their senior project in undergraduate work in college, and they will ask Mel and I to solve their problem. It's a compliment that they have enough respect for us to think we can do that. But now, let's look at the bigger picture. The very nice people of Limark allow us the time on this machine to cover material that is of greatest interest to the greatest number of people. That's the intent of the TechNet. We accept the fact that ham radio is a fairly complicated hobby. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. So a guy is going to have questions, particularly a newbie, is going to have questions of what transmission line should I buy, what transmitter should I buy, what receiver should I use, how do I know I've got a good one, what antenna, how high up, what kind of performance am I going to get, which one of the 26 ham radio types is going to keep me happy. I mean, more general questions that please the majority of what's required. Very similar to what goes on with QST Magazine. In theory, each article in QST Magazine is of a nature to give the most amount of information in a form that the most number of readers can accept. And are you going to find a doctoral thesis on some very esoteric thing in QST? Of course not. The more esoteric things appear in the QTC, or the QEX, the Experimenters Exchange, are the more technical articles. And by the same token, Mel and I have to choose the things, first of all, that we really know something about, or we at least have an opinion about. We can admit what we don't know, but we have to try to keep it a little bit more general and not dig in too deep on any one subject. The major flack I used to get before Mel joined this operation was that, hey, you're spending much too much time on each individual subject. Well, what I did was to ask the question multiple weeks in a row. Hey, you guys, do you want the very brief answer, or do you want the slightly extended answer? And the question and the answer always came back, give us all the brief answer, but when you get to my subject, I want the whole story. The majority of people told me that, so I really realized what's going on. I'm just going to keep doing it the best way I know how. Yeah, I'm a little bit verbose, and I ramble quite a bit, but somewhere buried in there is some information that hopefully somebody can use. But we, Mel and I, have to keep it general. No, we don't have a two-hour conference every week where he and I get together and say, should we discuss this one or should we discuss that one? I have not volunteered to answer questions in writing. Mel is a much more dedicated guy than I am. He has volunteered to answer people's written questions as long as they are sufficiently general that we believe the majority would find it interesting. And so if somebody asks us the question of how should I open up my own company to go in competition with Alan Bradley and build carbon composition resistors, that's much too specific. I just chose that one out of the air. You see what I mean? So I guess these guys are going to have to accept the fact that only a small percentage can we try to answer, and we're going to choose the ones that we think are most general, of most interest to the greatest number of people, and I know we're going to make some people unhappy. We've had to accept that ahead of time. We know we're going to make people unhappy. We can't please everybody all the time. We make an attempt at it. K2KUY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KUY. That's basically, as Dick just put it, concise, that we can only do so much, and we are flattered that we think that we have the capabilities of actually reviewing such work. As I could say, it's very thankfully that, you know, you believe in us, but we just can't, you know, handle this. It's not the forum for it. All right, here we go. Let's see. I got a problem here. Okay. I've got interference, TVI interference, on 20 meters, but it shows up at 3 times the frequency or 5 times the frequency. What do you think I should do? I've tried a couple of different low-pass filters. Where do you think my problem lies? Well, what can you do about this? I think I once had some experience in this, but all right, Dick, what do you think?
Okay, there's at least 2 different ways that you can get third harmonic and fifth harmonic frequency from 20 meters. 20 meters, 14 megacycles. Third harmonic is roughly 48 megs, which is very close to the IF strip. Many television sets have a 45 megacycle IF strip. So as you generate any signal at 45 or 48 megacycles, and it could, in theory, go roaring right through the IF strip of the television set and come out on many channels. By the time you go to higher harmonics, you're going to fall into channel 2, 4, and 5 rather easily. Now, when a signal appears on your television screen from your ham radio piece of equipment, there's about 3 or 4 things that can have an influence on this. Number one, if the antenna you're using is closely mounted to the television aerial, that's going to give the television a lot more grief. Number two, if the coax cable or the transmission line you're using is not sufficiently shielded and properly balanced so that the transmission line, which runs alongside of a house very close to the television aerial, if you still have one, that can couple signals to it. So separating the antennas, making sure there's no signals on the transmission lines has helped. Nowadays, almost everybody's on cable TV, and therefore 98% of all the television interference has disappeared if the cable system is sufficiently tight and shielded. If you brought your piece of RG59 cable from your utility pole out there, your cable TV system, into the house, and in the house you put improper splitters, and you've divided up the wiring to go all over the house to feed 5 different TV sets, and that's not well shielded, so that now the wiring itself is picking up the signal from the ham radio transmitting antenna that's on the roof of the house 20 feet away, that can create a problem. And so how does the third harmonic get there? Well, is the transmitter generating third harmonic? Without a doubt, and fifth harmonic, without a doubt. However, if the antenna is meeting current FCC rules, and the transmitter is meeting current FCC rules, all of those harmonics are more than 60 dB down. In other words, the power of the harmonics is less than one millionth of the power of the transmitter. And so with reasonable separation of the antenna from the television set and reasonable shielding of the television set, that 1 millionth shouldn't create any grief. But if there's really close coupling, it could create grief. And the last thing I should mention is that even if the transmitter that's owned by the ham radio operator is perfectly clean, perfectly shielded, has a low-pass filter, which adds another 30 dB of rejection of all the harmonics, so that now you're into 90 dB of rejection, you would say, gee, there's no way that that third harmonic or fifth harmonic can appear on the TV set. There still is. You give a front end of a television set a strong enough signal, the television set itself will generate the third harmonic or the fifth harmonic of that signal. And as such, maybe you need a high-pass filter on the television set. every television set should have a high-pass filter. But the manufacturer